This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Zhang. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Zhang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Today we're going to be talking with a friend of Philip Agee, who passed away last Monday in Cuba. And we'll talk about and celebrate his life of activism and progressive work. With us on the air is Lou Wolf, a close collaborator of Phil, and also a co-author. Welcome, Lou.
Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Actually,
good afternoon where you are, yes.
It's morning, yeah, actually. It's 9 a.m.
I'm sorry, yes.
maybe you could talk about how you first met Phil Agee, who was a CIA officer who left the agency and wrote an expose about its operations.
I first met Phil in London in the fall of 1975, shortly after his book, Inside the Company, A CIA Diary, which is really the first book of its kind, the first book to tell the true story from inside about the CIA. There have been a number of books since then, but he was really, I think it's fair to say, the first major whistleblower against the CIA. And that book has been translated into over 30 languages around the world. And it's been read, I dare say, by I don't know how many million people, both in this country and other countries.
Yeah, I when I was in Vietnam, I even picked up copies of the book in Vietnamese.
Yes, that's right. I met Phil at a speech, the first public speech that he gave. That was in London in late 1975. I don't remember the exact date. I remember it was very cold that day in London, and this was a speech in Conway Hall, where the idea of public speaking was very new to him. Of course, in the many years after, he spoke hundreds and hundreds of times, but this was the first time he had spoken, and he already showed his mettle with. Because in his book he had told the story of the odyssey that he went through as he worked in the three countries where he was posted by the CIA, which were in Montevideo, in Ecuador, in the CIA station in Quito, then in Montevideo, Uruguay, and then in Mexico. The final one, he was posted there undercover as the Olympic attaché for the 1968 Olympics.
What really led him, in the book he explains it, but what really led him to expose the dirty work of the CIA?
Well, in the book he tells of what he went through as he came into the CIA. He was very, I won't say gung-ho as such, but he really, really believed, he bought into the idea that he could defend America. He didn't look on it as building democracy. That was not a notion in pretty much anyone's head. That's all come in under the umbrella of George Bush, this George Bush, but more in the sense of serving America as he saw it, and he was recruited after he'd been at Notre Dame, so he was brought up as a Catholic in a quite conservative family, a fairly wealthy family, and his notion was that although it was not a religious umbrella that he was under, it was more a idea of fighting communism as it was told then. But over the years, 12 years, that is, from 1956 55, I guess, to 68, almost 69, but it was altogether 14 years. Again, gradually, it was a gradual metamorphosis that he went through. He began to question what he was doing and what the CIA was doing and what the CIA stood for. Near the middle or end of his time in Montevideo, he was sitting in the office of the chief of police in Montevideo, and they were basically chit-chatting about various things, political developments and so forth. And then suddenly he said there was a sound of a man groaning, and it got louder and louder and louder, and then the man was screaming, and it was just in the next room, right next to the police chief's office. And Phil asked the police chief, "Well, what's that?" "Oh, Phil, compadre, Felipe, that's," and he gave his name, "the name of, that's the man you turned over to us last week, and we're working on him. We're going to find out what he knows." And the man was clearly being tortured.
You know, and then in the LA Times, op-ed that was critical of him this weekend, the author Tim Rutten said that he never accused the CIA of torture, but of complicity in torture. Is that true?
No, he did. I think it went beyond complicity as he saw it. He reported, as did the journalist A.J. Languth, about the fact that the CIA sent a very thin needle through the diplomatic pouch that was in Guatemala and in Chile, that was used for torturing men in their penis. And this piece of wire, which was thinner than any wire that you could buy on the open market, was electrified. So that, I think he saw that as torture by the CIA, though it was done by surrogates of the CIA.
For sure.
But they provided the tool to do it with.
We're talking with Lewis Wolf, who was the co-founder of COVID Action Information Bulletin. And actually, in the issue 498, Phil Agee writes about looking back at 20 years of COVID Action Quarterly then, and the annotation says he worked for the CIA from 57 to 68 when he resigned.
Yes.
So it's about 11 to 12 years.
12 years, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 12 years. So you went up, did you go up to him and talk to him before the meeting or after that London meeting?
No, after. A number of people, of course, wanted to speak to him. I mean, there was a huge crowd around him, and it must have been 30 people deep of people wanting to talk to him and shake his hand and congratulate him. Some of them, of course, that had not yet read his book. It had just been out a matter of a few weeks and was published by Penguin Books in London. So it was readily available. It wasn't available at all in the United States and was only available if you could get a smuggled copy or somehow somebody brought it across the border from Canada or somewhere or was mailed to you, but you couldn't buy it in any bookstore in the United States. Then later it was published by Stonehill Books and in English, well, obviously in English, but it was also then later published in other languages.
Right. I remember the paperback cover was, did it come out in hardback first before it came out in paperback in London? Because the paperback had the copy, a picture of the typewriter that was bugged, or the typewriter case that was bugged by the CIA while he was writing his manuscript.
That's right, and that's the actual typewriter that Penguin Books photographed. That was a typewriter that was handed to him by a woman who befriended, somehow got access to Phil, and he was living in Paris secretly.
Oh, in Paris,
In Paris, where the mother of his wife, then not yet wife to be, was living in Paris, and so he was living in this apartment secretly, and this woman befriended him and said, knew that he had said something like, "I'm working on a book" or something, but she was, of course, working for the CIA, and she ran through the rain and made a big show out of running through the rain with this typewriter under some another raincoat that she was protecting from the driving rains, and she huffed and puffed as she handed this typewriter to him and said, "I hope this helps you, Phil." Well, that typewriter, which he used then to work on the manuscript, the early stages of the manuscript for Inside the Company, and at one point he used to go out for coffee and pastry or something, and then he'd come back, and he walked down the stairs to his cellar, the cellar space where he was working, and he found this young man and woman in a passionate kiss, embrace in front of his door. And it was weird because he heard them talking as he came down the stairs, but then when they saw him, they suddenly threw their arms around him and started kissing. And it was so phony, you know, it was just bizarre. And it seems that they had been surprised by him. So he went into the apartment. They suddenly ran up the stairs and ran away. And he noticed that he heard their voices coming from, they had left the building, but he heard their voices on this typewriter. He's over in the part of the room where the typewriter was sitting on the desk, and so he walked over to the typewriter, and then he looked and he tried to find out where this was coming from. Then he suddenly realized there was a piece of the back of the typewriter was in a typewriter case,
right?
And the back of the typewriter case was sort of a little bit was peeling off, and he said, "Well, what's that?" And he peeled it back, and there he saw all of the each of the keys of the typewriter, of all the letters and symbols on the typewriter, were attached to a transmitter.
Each key was. Oh.
Each key was, yeah.
So
including the apostrophe and the period and the slash mark and everything was of course he didn't fully understand it at that time, but it became obvious to him very quickly because he knew something about the tradecraft of the CIA after 12 years, and it was clear to him very, very immediately what had happened, that this woman who had given him this typewriter was did it as a favor to the CIA or as an assigned job for them.
So they would know every time he typed something what letters he was typing. What letters?
Not only what letters, but where he was. So if the typewriter moved, if he
took
it with him somewhere, they would know exactly where he was. It was like a GPS, and long before there were GPSs.
Wow. So this was in Paris, not in London.
Huh. Right.
Wow. So he discovered it in Paris.
Yes.
Yeah. So he ripped it.
Needless to say, he no longer used the typewriter.
So it was in the case. But I don't understand, how could it, because the typewriter was attached to the case, so when you opened it, you were typing it in the case. Must be, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was like one, I think it was a Smith Corona, as I recall, and I suppose you could remove it. I used to have one like that back in college. And you could remove the typewriter, but I asked Phil about that once, and he said, "Well, I never got around to removing it. It was so easy to have it there, and then I'd close it so that it didn't get dusty or anything."
Oh. So maybe they sealed it. Then maybe they soldered it down or something. Yeah. Wow.
Well, if they had done their tradecraft right, he wouldn't have noticed this piece of this corner of the cover of the case was peeling off. They probably used super glue or something, and they missed that corner, and that's what he noticed.
They shouldn't have been transmitting back into the room.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Because he heard voices. Yeah. Wow. So they went. Did you meet him during this time he was writing the book? No.
No, I didn't know him then.
You didn't know? Did you know about the book?
I only knew it when it was published in 1975. I mean, with a lot of fanfare and
sure. He published it in England because he thought he couldn't get it published in the U.S. Initially.
Yes, that's right. But he wanted to publish it anywhere he could, but Penguin Books said, we want the book, and so that's where it was published. I don't know if any publisher at that moment was going to, you know, challenge the CIA by publishing it. I think that was not going to happen.
Yeah, to risk the line, I guess, the book line, yeah, the budget line, yeah. How about, so when you met him, what was he like when you finally did talk to him?
Well, I remember shaking hands with him and saying how extraordinary, I had just finished reading the book and how extraordinary it was, and what an amazing and courageous story he was telling. I mean, a true story, because it was obvious that it was true. It was straight from you know, the scene of the crime, as it were, the continuing, ongoing 12-year crime, I would say. And he was, he shook hands like he did with everybody, but as he later told me, that he had thought that, because I was pretty much, well, there were other Americans wanting to shake his hands too, but I said to him, I'd like to help you. Is there any way I can help you? And he said, he later told me all about this. He said he thought that the CIA had sent me to, to, you know, check him out, to see what he's working on now, to see how he got his information, to see, you know, all these things that the CIA would want to know in real time of what CIA was, what Phil was thinking and doing, where was his head was at, and so forth. Meanwhile, I thought, and I told him that, I didn't sell him that time in Conway Hall. I told him later, as we became very close friends, very quickly, I should point out, when we learned that we trusted each other. But I told him, I thought, Phil, I think you still have you have one foot inside the CIA. How could you possibly write this book? And how could the CIA let you write this book? And how could you not be in danger? Well, of course, I learned over the years that he was in danger that whole time, in grave danger from the CIA. And I can tell you more about that, but the point is that I didn't trust him and he didn't trust me. Within a week or 10 days after that first meeting at Conway Hall, we embraced and we pledged to work with each other forever, as long as it took. And that's what we did.
What did what you said that his life was in danger? What did you find out that the CIA was trying to do?
Well, he was under very, very, very close surveillance through all those years when he was traveling, when he was living in a number of different countries, six countries altogether that he was living in. First in Paris, and London was the place he tried to settle down. London and in Cambridge, England, and in Cornwall, a place called Truro in northern England. But then in a very large and public case, the British government determined that they were going to deport him, and there was a very extended and large and very popular campaign to force the British government to let him stay in the UK. It lasted for months and months and months in 1978, I think that was. And finally, he was not the only one. There was another journalist, American journalist, by the name of Mark Hosenball, who, interestingly enough, now works for Newsweek.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what they write in their issue this week. I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I wonder if Mark Hosenball writes it, because Mark chose to separate himself from Phil, and though at the time they were nominally, but they were sort of colleagues and investigating CIA activities in London and identifying CIA personnel. Most of that was done by other journalists, myself included, trying to track CIA personnel in London. Dozens of people, both operations officers and communications officers in the embassy in London, as well as other what is known as non-official cover personnel who weren't at the embassy. They were under what they called deep cover. Finally, when he was deported from London, he tried to take up residence in other countries, including in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Norway, and he was expelled from all of these countries. And Germany. In Germany. So it was six countries that he was deported from. And it was very clear, though we couldn't prove it at the time, but it was very clear that it was done at the behest of the United States government, and particularly the CIA. On one occasion, we learned that from a high government official in the Netherlands that he acknowledged that, yes, the United States had pressured his government to deport Phil, which is, of course, what happened.
How about the any physical attacks or attempts to eliminate him physically?
We did not, that we know of, there were not attempts, at least outward attempts. But there was information that came out that showed that the government, through a Freedom of Information Act request by his lawyer in New York, there was a document that came to Phil, or to Phil's lawyer, that said in great length, but a lot of it was blacked out. But there was a reference to the fact that they couldn't prosecute Phil not because of any legal reason, but because they were afraid were they to go through with that, through discovery, he could obtain documents that apparently indicated legal culpability of certain American, and you can put in brackets, intelligence personnel, would be legally liable for certain crimes. And the crimes, it appears, may have included plans to assassinate him.
And also
there was also
break-ins, probably, huh? Break-ins, breaking into his place.
Oh, yes, absolutely, all of the above. But there was also, at one point, an effort to induce him to go to travel to Spain. And he did go to Spain a number of times. But there were certain indications that suggest that they were going to kidnap him there.
Wow.
So, in answer to your initial question, yes, there were attempts, but, you know, nobody actually pulled a gun on him or anything like that. I will tell you a case that may have leaned in that direction, which was one time when I was doing research on CIA personnel in the British Museum in London. And I had a table there with all of the books sitting in front of me, and an American fellow walked into the reception area and said that asked for me by name. And Phil sometimes was there working with me, doing his reading, and so the man at the desk, who was actually a friend of mine, who was a British citizen working there as the reception. The guy in reception in the reference desk, the American leaned over the desk and handed him his ID, his driver's license. And as he leaned across the desk to hand the driver's license over, my friend noticed a gun under his jacket in his inside pocket.
Wow.
And he asked for me by name, and he didn't ask for Phil, but as I said, sometimes Phil was there, sometimes he wasn't. So we'll never know what that fellow was there to do, but he was immediately escorted out by security, British Museum security. I never found out what became of him. I asked the British Museum people, and they said we can't talk about it, but that's what happened.
That's the library, right? British
Museum is the library.
It's the
that's
library.
Where all their
yeah. all archives, their, yeah.
You know, records going back to the
archives. Yeah.
What century? I don't know.
yeah. Wow. How about in terms of just personally? What was he? How did he? Not personally, but politically. How did Phil changed his mind about the foreign policy of the U.S. How did that happen? You know, you mentioned the torture episode in Uruguay.
Well, it was thanks to his, after he left the CIA, one lives inside the CIA in a very compartmented and a very artificial environment in which generally they're not supposed to read newspapers, unless that's their assignment to read newspapers to, cut clippings and so forth. But that's the least of what they do. And they're not allowed to read history books or anything. That's just off limits for them. I mean, obviously, I'm sure some people go home and they read whatever they want. But supposedly, that's not permitted inside the CIA. And generally, I think that's the practice. And so they don't really understand American history or world history very much, except, of course, in the country where they're assigned. That's what they're supposed to know everything about what's going on there. And not only what's going on, but who they can buy and who they can manipulate and who they can compromise and who, if in the end they have to, who they have to overthrow and who they have to assassinate. That's what they do. I mean, that's their day job. That's what they do. And that's their night job, by the way. And Phil, when he left the agency in 1968, he had no idea that he was going to write a book. He had no thought about that. He just was feeling very worried about the fact that he'd done this kind of work for 12 years. And then he started reading. At that point, he went to the libraries where he went first in Paris, and then, as I said, and then in after he wrote the book, he went. I think to Cuba was the first place he went to, and they said, well, if you want to learn more about the history, you can use the state library, which had all kinds of books from all over the world and newspapers, all the files of all the newspapers in the countries where he had worked, and all the New York Times and the Washington Post and all other media from Eastern Europe to Western Europe to Latin America to Asia to Africa. They had it all. And so he started to read, and he, of course, spoke Spanish very fluently, and he spoke some other languages less fluently, but his eyes were opened, in the space of a few months of reading, and that's when he started to question some of the assumptions that he had throughout the time he was at the CIA.
Did he? When did he come to realize he had to name names?
Well, he named names in the book. There are over 200, I think it's 200 and 250 people, both Americans and nationals of the countries where he was working, who were working with the CIA. The Americans on the CIA payroll, the others, some other nationalities on as assets or as agents, as they're called. I think sometimes in the discussion about the CIA, people misunderstand these terms. If you're in the CIA, on the CIA payroll, you were an operations officer, or you're an analyst, a CIA analyst. But if you're a national of the countries, of those countries where they're working, you're an agent. So, you know, that you have to draw that distinction. In any case, he had named those people at that time, and those were basically every name of every person that he could remember working with. And this was all from memory. He hadn't kept a written diary. I mean, it was all, you know, from his memory. But, of course, these people were colleagues, you know, whether they were the Americans in the embassy or the nationals in those countries, you know, working as journalists or as police, as intelligence officers, local officials, and in some cases heads of state, and they were who were on the CIA payroll. So he named everyone that he knew when he was in the agency in that first book. Later, he and I and other journalists decided that not for any other reason than that we felt that they were accountable, and he felt, I should say first and foremost, that they were accountable for what they were doing in these countries, that, you know, the whole range of the activities, the whole gamut, from manipulating local officials to buying elections to taking over trade unions to collaborating with and I should say more than collaborating, that as it was the case, actually creating intelligence and police services, the agencies of repression in those countries. And if you take it up the line, the other things that they were doing were, you know, up to and including overthrowing governments and assassinating heads of state. But as part of that, the major activity of the CIA was both economic destabilization, a term that became sort of, you know, everyday language during the Reagan administration, because they used it, destabilization. And then the paramilitary activities of the CIA, in terms of arming, creating and arming private armies and hit squads and death squads.
Yeah, in the book you co-author, Lou, with Phil, Dirty Work, the first Dirty Work book, there's a chapter, he writes the introduction about myths, and he said one myth is naming individual CIA officers does little to change the agency and is done only to expose innocent individuals to the threat of assassination. So he mentions the need for people to be personally accountable for what the agency, what they in the agency does. They are the Gestapo and SS of the time, and as in the Nuremberg trials and the war in Vietnam, he wrote, they cannot shed their individual responsibility simply because they were following a superior's order. But apart from the question of personal responsibility, the CIA remains a secret political police, and the exposure of its secret operations and secret operatives remains the most effective way to reduce the suffering they cause.
And that, I think, expresses the Phil that I know and knew, and that's from his heart. That was what he truly believed. That was not rhetoric for him. That was really how he saw it.
Yeah. He also talks in that introduction about the myth that the critics of the CIA are KGB agents. And of course, he was tied with that smear.
Yes, that's right. And it should also be very clear to your listeners that he never wanted to see anybody scratched or killed as a result. That was the last thing he wanted to see happen from identifying them. And indeed, never, ever was a single person that he named or that I named or that other journalists have named who were CIA personnel has ever been killed or scratched as a result. And that even includes the case of Richard Welch, and who was the CIA station chief in Athens, who was assassinated in 1975. December 23rd, 1975, he was assassinated outside of his the front steps of his home. The people who took, if you will, credit for it, in a manifesto that they issued, the November 23rd movement. November 17th, thank you, which was named after a day in Greece when the military junta had committed an assassination of a number of people, of leftists. And so they undertook, as an underground guerrilla group, to take revenge and to take action against CIA personnel who were identified very, very closely with the military junta in Greece at that time, which was extremely repressive. But they did say in their manifesto that they had planned to assassinate for months. They had planned the very down to the finest detail to assassinate a man by the name of Stacy Hulse. Stacy Hulse was the chief of station in Athens, and one day suddenly he was transferred to Canada, where he became the chief of station, and he was replaced by Richard Welch. And they had planned to, as I say, to assassinate Hulse, but they went ahead with, and they described in the manifesto sitting two rows behind Richard Welch in the movies. They described all of his habits. You know, they had him under very close surveillance. But the bottom line here in the Welch case, which was blamed on Phil Agee wrongly and falsely, the bottom line is that everybody in Athens who wanted to know knew where the CIA chief of station lived. It was well known. It was so well known that the tourist buses would drive by the house and the driver would point that out. That's where the head of the CIA lives. And they didn't necessarily know his name, but they knew where he lived. And to this day, those tour buses still drive by that same place. I think the house has actually probably changed now, but anyway, the point is clear.
So the point is that the CIA, people knew that the CIA head of station lived in that apartment.
And that underlines their stupidity, because simple CIA tradecraft would tell them, don't live in that same house. And in fact, Richard Welch himself was told by the CIA, don't take up residence in that house. Everybody knows where it is. And he wrote back in cables that were later revealed that, and written up in the Washington Post in great detail, he was told, don't live there, everybody knows. And he said, no, we like the house, my wife likes the curtains, it's near the embassy, and so forth. And so he decided that they would live there.
Yeah, it's actually the November 17, it is November 17, group.
But he was killed December 23rd, that's right.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you find that what do you see as his legacy? The CIA is still growing strong despite the, exposure of the dirty work and the congressional investigations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More than going strong, they are in many ways, I would say, more powerful than ever today in the Bush era. And that's hard to imagine more powerful than ever, but they have been given license, and I blame Congress for this, that they've given them a blank check, particularly since September 11, 2001, to do pretty much whatever they want. Within certain limits, there is the oversight function of the House and Senate, the two intelligence committees. But it showed itself very clearly when the CIA leaked to the New York Times the fact that they had briefed the intelligence committees, both committees and both parties. You know, it was on a nonpartisan basis. They call it the Club of Six, or no, the Club of Eight, which are eight members of Congress who are briefed, and excluding their staffs, excluding anybody else. And all of these eight people are members of those committees who are sworn to secrecy. They're not allowed to talk about anything that they are told in those secret, top secret meetings.
About the videotaping,
yes,
of the torture.
Yes, about the torture tapes, that's right.
Yeah.
And so they were told, it now appears, over 2 years or 3 years ago about the existence of these tapes. They were also told that there was a consideration of them being destroyed because it was never explicitly stated, apparently, why, but that they would be destroyed. And you don't have to be, you know, Albert Schweitzer or somebody to know to see why. I mean, it's not rocket science. They wanted to destroy the evidence of waterboarding. It's not about protecting the identities of those people. I mean, we've all seen tapes that are the faces are blurred so you don't see who they are. They could have done that. They would still show the waterboarding but not show who's doing it to the prisoners. But I should point out regarding waterboarding that waterboarding was a practice the United States engaged in back in the year 1899 and 1900 and 1901 in the Philippines. I found photographs of the waterboarding that the U.S. Army was doing to Filipino, innocent Filipinos in that period, in the Philippine-American, so-called American War.
That's when,
so it didn't just start recently.
Right, and that's when they were coined the term gooks to call the Filipinos then.
That's right.
And it was used later in Vietnam, of course.
Exactly. Yeah, there was actually a front page photograph in the New York Times of waterboarding in Vietnam, which
wow.
I found when I was researching the question. So, you know, the United States is not innocent to any degree on this matter.
So what do you see as Phil's legacy?
Well, he's a man who really, truly, you think about the issue of morality, and he really believed in the fact that what was wrong with American policy was that, in the first instance, the human costs of U.S. policies, whether it was CIA policies and practices or whether it was other parts of the government that create the conditions that we create in other countries, the desperation, the anger, the hatred of America, not of the American people, but of the government that practices aggressive policies towards those countries. And country after country after country after country that we overthrow their governments, we manipulate their elections, and all the other things that we've discussed. And Phil really, truly understood that. I'm still talking about it in the present tense. It's hard to believe that he's gone physically from us. But he really stood for the highest principles. I know some CIA former colleagues of his have condemned him. In fact, there's a woman in Florida who wrote a letter to the organization Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which is a dissident group of former CIA personnel that's founded in Washington, that's been very outspoken against U.S. policies. And you may know about Ray McGovern, who stood up physically in front of Dick Cheney and called him a liar. He was one of the founders, and this woman, a former CIA person, said, quote, I hope Philip Agee died an extremely painful death because of all the American CIA personnel that were killed as a result of him naming him. Well, there's the lie. It never happened. and for her to say that, you know, I hope he died painfully, which he did, I should point out, is sort of a sad comment on these people that believe the ends, bad as they are, the ends justify the means. And They would have liked to boil Phil alive if they could have.
For sure, yeah.
And I will say to you, Dan, I believe it may be hard to prove, but I'm sure history will end up showing that somehow in the CIA, the day that Phil died last Monday at 10:45 at night, the next day they had a celebration at CIA headquarters, whether it was a party or toasting, or probably more likely a memo went out on the internal bulletin that they have to all CIA personnel to the effect that the greatest enemy of the CIA is now dead. Hooray!
Right, right. I'm sure. How do you feel?
Sad comment, and
how do you?
One day we'll know the truth.
How do you see his struggle continuing?
Well, there are hopefully ways that we can continue his work. I know there are. There are people around the world that appreciate what he did, and in this country there will be a memorial to Phil. We don't yet have the date. We don't know exactly when and where, but it will happen.
Will it be in New York, probably?
Perhaps, yes. And also, we hope that it will be possible to republish a lot of his work that he did. I mean, he wrote not just the books that he wrote, but also many, many articles.
Yeah.
Many interviews, including, I think, by you. Didn't you have a radio interview with him?
I can't remember. I don't think I did, but I did visit him in Hamburg, and now I can't remember if I taped anything. I was like
in
such a rush.
Go back and check your archives.
I know.
I think you did.
Sometimes I interview people, but I haven't edited.
Amy Goodman on Democracy Now,
yeah,
including the New York Times and the Washington Post and the L.A. Times and the London Guardian, and on and on and on. I mean, he was widely quoted and widely, because of his credibility. I mean, it's not just because he worked at the CIA, but because he was a profoundly intellectual man and a man who stood for something. And so people understood that.
What you've read some of the obituaries that have come out. What is your reaction to them?
I haven't seen the one in the L.A. Times. I heard that was...
That was an op-ed to the Washington Post obit.
Right, well... Doesn't that say something? They couldn't find something original to say. I mean, they have to quote each other.
Which is better, probably. If they had done something original, they might be worse.
Who knows? I think, well, the New York Times one I thought was reasonably accurate. They did talk about Richard Welch and that he had been blamed for that assassination, but that others have pointed out the apparent fact that that was not the case, and it's more than apparent, it's definite. It did quote Phil, so I thought that was quoted me. And
you're quoted, yeah, and Phil Shapp, yeah.
Yes. And I thought that was reasonable by one of the best journalists that I know, Scott Shane, who used to work for the Baltimore Sun. So
The Guardian had a piece by Duncan Campbell.
Yes.
Who was also a kind of fellow traveler, in a sense. In some sense, of exposing CIA secrets. Intelligence secrets in England.
That's correct, yes. And not only American secrets, but also British secrets.
Right, right, yes. Right. Definitely. Did you find that how was he able to keep the steady pace of his writing up to the end? Some people get burned out, lose faith in doing this stuff. How was he able to maintain maintain it?
He was tireless. I mean, I hate to say it, he died a very tired man.
Because
he never stopped working. And his work ethic was extraordinary. And maybe he shouldn't have worked as hard because of his health. I mean, his health in the end, he lost the battle. But he was a man who never stopped working, never stopped looking for the truth, not just about the CIA, but far beyond, the confines of the CIA. He really was an extraordinary intellectual historian of the world, but his allegiance was not to any country, but to truth, and he, some would say truth as he saw it, but it was truth, and I think he will go down in history as a great patriot. He actually, I didn't see it, but somebody told me yesterday, there was a piece on ABC News yesterday, which profiled three people who had died this past week. Sir Edmund Hillary, who climbed Mount Everest. I'm sorry, I don't know who the third person was, and Phil Agee. And they told me that the piece on Phil Agee was quite objective, and it actually included a clip with Phil. You might check that out.
Definitely. Do you see overall that the media depictions have been fairer than you thought?
Say it again, I couldn't hear you.
Has the media write-ups, have they been fairer than you expected?
Some have, some haven't.
The blogs have been pretty anti, I think, the right-wing blogs especially, of course.
Well, I haven't looked at the blogs. Probably that's true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I got one somebody sent me from the Herald Sun, I think, which is in New Zealand, I believe, and it was just like four one-sentence paragraphs, and one each worse than the one before. So, you know, that's all they did. But
Did you, when he got his surveillance, FOIA, under the Freedom of Information Act, Phil got his, or his lawyer got the documents, how big was it? Do you remember?
He got, I think it was over 80,000 pages. He once calculated that they had, I don't know how many man-hours that they had devoted to, you know, generating that much paper. I mean, all the forests that were taken down to make that file. It was extraordinary. I mean, and of course, there's still thousands of pages that have not been released and, in fact, are being withheld by various government agencies, including the Justice Department, the CIA, the FBI, and the State Department. I don't know if the Agriculture Department has a file, too, but, you know, everybody was interested in Phil Agee.
Yeah, I'm sure when, you know, because of my own files, that was because I visited him. I'm pretty sure that was it, yeah.
Well, all credit goes to you, Dan, for being the one that forced the CIA to actually physically change their website because of their spying on you, and they had to admit that they aren't supposed to spy in the United States except in certain circumstances, which was or spy on Americans, I should point out. And
permanent residents,
on their website that's not fully true.
Even permanent residents, yeah. And, of course, after 9/11, all bets are off.
That's right. Yeah.
But Phil definitely led a, you know, exemplary life, with his progressive work, and is a model to all of us.
And I should point out, from the human interest side, he left two wonderful sons and a wife, and they will never forget their father.
Yeah, and actually we'll be talking to, hopefully, to one of them next show or in a coming show.
Yes.
To Phil Jr., I believe.
Yes.
Who is on his way back to this country. Well, thank you, Lou, for taking the time.
Thank you, Dan, very much.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. We've been talking with Lewis Wolf, who is the founder of COVID Action Quarterly now. Now is in abeyance, the magazine, but for a long time it was a crusading magazine against the CIA, and he also was co-author with Phil Agee of Dirty Work, a massive expose of the dirty work of the CIA. We've been remembering the life and times of Phil Agee, the former CIA case officer who went public after resigning from the agency and wrote a book called Inside the Company, and later wrote a biography about his life on the run called On the Run. This is Dan Zhang signing off with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Zhang signing off.